How's it going, everybody? And welcome back to yet another episode of the Onward Podcast. We have really a heavy, but I think needed and incredible topic of conversation today with just a wonderful guest. But before we jump into that, I wanted to just say thank you so much for your support and listening to the show. If you'd be so kind as to leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on, that would help us so much. What else would be of just a humongous, this is not the best sentence, but what else would be helpful? Another thing that would be helpful, that's what I was looking for, would be if you've got someone else that you know is working in ministry and they're doing their best to serve God's kingdom, share an episode with them. We're covering a range of topics with a range of guests. And if this resource is something that's helpful for you, a simple share or review could go a long way for us. That's about all I got up front. I'd love to just jump right into introducing our guest for today. His name is Dave Keene. Dave is a 30-year vet of youth and student ministry. He is a professor at Biola University, and he's also a lead pastor at Cornerstone Community Church in San Clemente, California. Some would say, how does he wear all those hats? Because in addition to that, he also runs a foundation, the Adam Keene Foundation. And I am so thrilled to introduce you all to my friend Dave today. And I believe that the message that he carries and the life that he's lived is something that's going to inspire all of us who have a chance to sit with him and his wisdom today. Dave, so thank you so much for being on the show today. How are you?
I'm going to try to live up to that introduction, man. I feel like I actually am someone significant, and that's not normally how I think of myself as that important. So I appreciate the build up there.
I literally read it off your Biola faculty page.
Yep, there's a lot there.
He's written books.
I've learned to be very intentional with my time. I love what I do. I just love a lot of things. So God has been gracious with me.
Dave, you've been in the game for a long time. How long would you consider yourself having served in like what we would traditionally call vocational ministry?
I'm coming up to my 38th year between youth pastor and a lead pastor, teaching pastor, then lead pastor. So
is now a bad time to tell you I'm 37?
Yeah, I you know what? I'm a grandfather, so I embrace it. I mean, I realize, one of my things I was really excited about was being a youth pastor to my own kids, you know, and so I was a youth pastor before they were born, and both my daughter Amy and son Adam were in my youth ministry, and now, I have a chance as a professor at Biola to kind of work alongside many, many people that are, younger than what my kids are. And so I used to think of myself as like a Biola dad to my students, but now in many ways, I think of myself as a Biola grandfather to a lot of my students. So I'm definitely recognizing I've been around for a while. So.
Well, your reputation for someone who's been in ministry as long as you have is commendable. We have a mutual friend and my pastor, Kevin Reynolds. And before I met you, he was already speaking so highly of you and telling me you're someone I needed to get to know. So you've been doing something right, my friend. You've been doing something right.
Thank you. Kevin's wife, Jennifer, was actually one of my very first students when I first started in youth ministry. So, wow. I mean, I go way back with Kevin and his family and feel like a spiritual grandpa to his church.
That's so cool. Yeah, that's amazing. What would you describe your role at Biola as, Dave? What do you do there?
So I'm the department chair for ministry. I'm a full-time professor, so I teach classes in youth ministry, church ministry. I teach a couple of Bible classes on how to study the Bible, teach classes on understanding your calling to ministry. So a variety of discipleship-focused, ministry-focused classes. I oversee the internship program as well for all of our students and getting them hands-on real life experience doing ministry before they graduate. And what I love about my role is I consider myself Yoda. I mean, I am not the smartest person in the classroom usually. I mean, I'm okay with that. But what I do have is experience. And so my style of teaching is very much more like discussion led, very much like I'm just going to be a guide on your journey. And so I tell students, you're not paying a lot of money to hang out, to go to Biola and get my content. You're paying a lot of money to go to Biola and just hang out in the classroom with the professors. And I take it a privilege to be one of those. And so, yeah, most of my day at Biola, I'm either teaching in a classroom or hanging out at the coffee shop on campus, just talking to students about life and ministry and God. And so, it really is a passion of mine to mentor the next generation of ministry leadership, whether it's for the church or parachurch or mission organizations. And I'm very blessed to be able to do that and influence hundreds of students every year.
Wow, that's amazing. And like you said, 38 years in ministry. If we rewound the clock 38 years, how did you get started in this career path?
Well, I knew God called me to ministry early on because while I was in high school and even middle school, I had a passion for taking what I was reading in my Bible and sharing with my friends. And so I just had a natural connection of doing that. I felt a burden to share, to show my friends that Jesus was relevant. Led different Bible studies for my friends. Was the Bible club president on my high school campus for 3 years. I knew God had his hand on me early on, and so I knew I wanted to pursue that. In my freshman year, I went to Azusa Pacific and right away got connected as an intern at a church. And I was so young that they said, we're only going to let you work with middle school because I was too young to work with high school and too immature to work with children. And so they said, you can work with middle school and fell in love with middle school ministry. And God just grew the ministry with me. So as I grew as in my understanding of ministry, I grew from the junior high intern, then my junior year of college, I became the junior high director and God started to expand the ministry. I was doing a lot of stuff on the high school and middle school campuses and so the ministry just started really growing. And so the church when I graduated from Azusa Pacific made me the full-time junior high youth pastor and then the overall high school, middle school, youth pastor. And I realized very early on that I was going to be the bottleneck of reaching these students for Christ. That, as we were having hundreds of kids come to our church, well, the church was growing, but it had no money. So I couldn't hire another youth pastor. And so basically, what I had to realize is I had to put my energy into training up my volunteers to be the youth pastor. So I might be the speaker, but we transitioned our ministry to a mentor-led, small group-driven youth ministry. And so we'd have a couple of hundred middle schoolers every night, and the next night we'd have a couple of hundred high school students. And I was developing 60 volunteers and a couple interns and running that program. And so what I realized is that was my sweet spot. If I was just to hang out with students, I'd probably be a firefighter right now because I am the senior chaplain for Orange County Fire and I love riding on fire trucks. But God made it very clear that my role was not just to be a youth pastor, but was to train others to do ministry. That way, this church could reach the hundreds of students that we had because the leaders are being trained well. And that became my understanding of where my role was meant to be in God's kingdom work. And that's what led me to go back to seminary. I went to Talbot Seminary, was offered a job as a part-time professor, an adjunct professor at Biola University right when I was graduating. And so that idea of putting myself in places where I could be impacting the next generation of ministry leaders became really my focal point. And so that really was how I structured our ministry. So I was at my first church for 14 years, and God brought us down to the beach in Dana Point to be a youth pastor at a church in Dana Point for 15 years.
I love when God does that kind of stuff.
Oh, it's praise God,
I was a
hallelujah.
youth pastor in Bakersfield, and then from there went to Hume Lake, and it was like, thank you so much, God.
Yeah, God is good. He gives us our desires when we want to honor Him. And then after I went full time at Biola, I was still part time leading that ministry in Dana Point. And then a buddy of mine just asked if I would helped come over and be his teaching pastor and mentor his staff, and now I'm the lead pastor of that church by default because he retired during this of COVID. So
He totally had that in mind, didn't he?
he did. He
He
set
did
me
you
up
dirty.
hard, hard, hard. But what I love is in all of my roles, I really try to have the focus of how do I equip the next person to do my job? And that really has been my mindset of to work myself out of the job, because what that usually means then is that there's another step that God has for me to take. And it's not, I've never been unemployed. I've never had to go seek a job, praise God. It's always been as I've worked myself out of jobs, God has the next piece right there ready for me to take. And in his grace, he's done that for 38 years. We'll see what God has in store for us for the next season. But yeah, that was how I became who I am today.
Wow. And so it sounds like you were doing a model of student ministry that is modern today, but 38 years ago
Yeah.
with groups and, hey, I'm your youth pastor, but your small group leader is really the one that you should look to for your primary, kind of shepherding. How'd you discover that?
By default, because we had so many students, we had to figure out, okay, how do we manage this? And so, as we were doing a lot of ministry on the local campuses, we started getting students together by, okay, if you go to this high school, go there. If you go to that high school, go there, around the room. And so then we just started assigning leaders to that. And what I started to hear from students is like they came to find their small group leader. They weren't coming to hang out with me. They weren't coming to have fun or even to listen to my beautiful Bible study. They're like, hey, is Joe here tonight? I'm looking, my small group leader, where is he? Because, and I all of a sudden caught on like, that's what they're needing. They're needing love and attention. So I was having students that were had nothing to do with God, but were coming to our youth group because they're being loved by their small group leader. And so what I told my small group leaders is like, okay, you're going to have a bunch of students, and I know you can't care for them, you can't mentor them all, but we took Jesus' model where, he selected 12, he graduated 11, and he mentored three, right? So he cared for them all, but he really gave Peter, James, and John extra attention. And that's what I told my volunteers, like, everybody has a partner. You pick the three that you want to mentor, your partner picks a different three. Most likely, that's about all in your group that really want to run and get to know Jesus more. And so let's just run with those who want to run and love on all of them out, the rest of them. And that became the secret sauce that students were like, they were just coming because they knew they'd be loved. And that became just a really kind of the model for how we sought to develop these ministries.
Yeah, it seems like that setting others up for success has been kind of paramount to the way that you've done ministry. I've even experienced that firsthand. You and I met because your foundation sponsored some of the events that Onward was putting on around Southern California. And I mean, you made it so easy for me to succeed. It seems like that's kind of a value that you've brought into ministry.
I think I've learned that because in the beginning, in your pride, you look at your large ministry and you think, all right, I'm going to go to the next big church. I'm going to get the next platform. And God never gave me the platform of like a national speaker, but God did give me influence in people's lives. And I've realized I'm okay with that. I don't need to be a known name because known names are fine. I know all the known names, I've been around them, but what I realize is that as I promote other people, students' lives are changed at a deeper level. Because there was a season of my ministry where we were a mile wide and an inch deep. I had hundreds of students coming, and there was zero life change out of that season because I made the focal point me and like, come and hear me, and let's make how big can we get? And when I realized there was no life change of any significance out of that year, I'm like, we got to do it different because that was a waste of time. And so that's when I pivoted and said, I got to take me out of the bottleneck look position and just expand this so that my leaders are empowered to do what I do.
As you're talking, you talk about these different seasons of ministry, seasons of leadership. What have been some of the seasons in your 38 years that have really kind of stood out to you? Maybe there's lessons or events in there that God has really just kind of gotten a hold of you with.
Well, I think that first one was it's, you know, if I can focus on empowering other people, that was that first big step I took. And then I went from this very large ministry, and we were headhunted to go down to Dana Point and restart a youth ministry from scratch. And I thought, well,
That's
hey,
never easy.
well, I thought, well, hey, I did it once. I can just do
Yeah.
it again. And God used that to really just humble me and teach me what it means just to really lean into his journey for me. In other words, I had ideas of how we're going to do this, and those really fell flat. And even I was trying that mentoring idea, you know, we're going to have all these small groups. And you know, I would say that model is still what we did, but I had to be patient for God to show me the new path on that journey, that the new, you know, it wasn't going to look exactly the same. And I had to understand what that meant. Like, you know, okay, this ministry is going to look different in some ways, although some of my key values won't change, some of those other things would have to change, you know. And so I think, you know, learning how to consistently remake yourself, because not just do your students constantly change over, but I think, you know, as I was getting into my, you know, 20th year of youth ministry, I'm like, okay, I can do a simple youth ministry with no internet, with no effort. So I started to really think about other aspects of our ministry. And so we launched a real thriving missions aspect to our youth ministry. And we actually sponsored an orphanage in Johannesburg, South Africa, where our students were raising $90,000 a year to
Wow.
run this organization.
Wow.
And, you know, so I, you know, just to put myself out there, like, what's the next thing? And then, you know, just kind of just saying, okay, God, what do you have for me? And then, you know, as God was transitioning me from full-time youth ministry to full-time professor, like, okay, God, what does that look like? And how do I still have a pastor's heart while working as a professor? So trying to understand what that really means to be pastoral, even if you don't have the title, you know, because you're a professor and students are looking to you more as a teacher than they are a pastor sometimes. And so you have to kind of be pastoral till they understand who you are for them. And then you can take that to the next level. So.
Wow. Yeah, it seems like you have a high level of awareness of the different iterations of ministry that God's had you doing. And that tends to follow some intention and some thoughtfulness, which I think a lot of us in ministry were so in the moment, I guess. You know, it's so easy to just look at what's on your desk or in your inbox for that day that you kind of forget to maybe pause and journal to look back. Take note of the good seasons, take note of the hard seasons, the difficulties. Are there things that you have done to kind of stay with it, I suppose? Are there practices, say, is it journaling? Is it mentorship? Like, what are the things that you've done to kind of just take account of the different things that God's had you serving within his kingdom for?
I would say the primary practice for me is Sabbath keeping, to really take a weekly pause. I use that time to read God's word a little more. I use that time to read a variety of books, not just ministry books, but business books and spiritual formation books and theology books. I use that time to rejuvenate in other ways that I enjoy. And what I find in doing that is it gives me that space just to kind of hear where God may be leading. My wife and I try to go away every year for our anniversary. And part of that time of going away and celebrating our anniversary is not just looking back, but it's also saying, hey, in 5 years, where do we want to be in our marriage? Where do we want to be in life, in my ministry? And when you, on a yearly basis, think about where you want to be in 5 years, it helps you start working towards that. And that's actually some of the those that practice was foundational to me making some of these pivots to no longer just be doing ministry the way I was doing it, but recognizing things were changing or had to change, and I needed to be intentional with that change or I'd be left out. And by being intentional and knowing where I kind of what God was calling us to, I was ready for when a change was needed, right? When I left one church and went to a different church, or, you know, understanding that, okay, this season is coming to a close. Sometimes it's hard to recognize a season's coming to a close because we have really valued that season. We've enjoyed that season. There's been fruit in that season. And so to say before there's no more fruit, right? Hey, this season's coming to a close. That takes some honesty. That takes some humility to say, you know what? There's things that are going on that I should be thinking differently. And so God's been very good, whether it's through mentors of mine who helped me or just spending time processing myself. I've always kind of understood there's a change about to take place here because my heart's changing, right? That's where I saw the first change. Like my passion was changing. My desires to do something was different, right? And so it wasn't like I couldn't do the job anymore. But it was like, you know what? I'm interested in doing something else. And they become significant enough that I can't keep being the youth pastor here. If I want to do that, I need to make a change. And so I've been by kind of being before the change, I'm able to walk through the change more easily than the change being forced upon me. Like, hey, you're out of a job here and now we're scrambling. I've always been like, God, you're leading me, it seems, into a different season, to a different place. Let me start preparing for that way in advance so that it doesn't come to a surprise to anybody. But it's been, like I said, working myself out of a job is kind of how I operate. And so even now, I mean, the church I'm the lead pastor at, I went to the elders and said, hey, you know what? We need to have a 5-year transition plan because I'm 55 now. When I'm 60, I need to be doing something different, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, it sounds weird, like, hey, a 5-year transition plan, but that could go faster or slower, but at least I'm thinking, God, where are you leading us next?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that level of thoughtfulness and intention has helped in things even outside of ministry, right? Oh, yeah. You know, one of the ways that you and I met, Dave, was through the work that your foundation is doing. And if you're okay with that, I'd love to talk a little bit about the foundation and just your story of how that came to be.
Yeah. Life sometimes doesn't become what you expect it to be. And the Adam Keene Foundation is named after our son, Adam, who passed away unexpectedly, suddenly from a brain aneurysm in June of 2022. And I tell people it was in one moment, you're on your highest of highs. Think life was great and wonderful. Adam was married. He was a youth pastor. He was thriving in his ministry. He was about to be a father. His wife was 9 months pregnant. And then you get a phone call and your entire world is wrecked. And just trying to understand the process of grief was in some ways overwhelming because there is no answer. Scripture never gives us an answer of why we suffer. And the reality that we live in a fallen, broken world of sin doesn't do enough to help you through painful times.
Yeah.
Yes, we have death in our world because of our sin, but that doesn't support or comfort us when you're struggling. And so
it's almost offensive when people pull that line because it's
100%.
Please don't belittle, you know, my mom passed away in July and people would say that. Like, please don't.
Yeah.
Don't deduct her life to a fallen world. She was so much more.
And then Christians, we want to diminish this world and life by saying, well, your son's in heaven at least. And I'm like, yes, but interesting enough, if you look at the scriptures, the early church didn't operate like, I just can't wait to get to heaven. That was Paul and definitely how Paul talked, but the early church was just looking forward to the final resurrection. And so they are all about God's kingdom on earth coming, not us going to be in heaven. And so the idea that we can just diminish people like, well, at least they're in heaven. No, there's a loss there. And truly trying to help Adam's wife as she gave birth to a beautiful baby girl, Kinsley, and then, helping my own family. It's just been a journey to say, God, how do we make sense of this? And one of the ways that we have sought to continue Adam's story is by his foundation to come alongside young leaders and want to encourage them and equip them. And that's really kind of how we think. You know, a way we think is Jesus has the final say and Adam's story is not over. And because Adam's story doesn't end here, we believe that there's a legacy for Adam still to be experienced. And that really has been healing for us to some degree. In some ways it was a distraction in the beginning, but grief is something that's so overwhelming that I think sometimes you need the distraction because you can't sit in that pain forever. You need something to pull you out and to help you see that life is bigger and continues. And that's hard because so many people go on with their lives and so many people go on with the good things that God gives us. And we are still trying to put our lives back together. I told people when I came back to our church and I preached my first message after being gone for 3 months that I told them, I said, I still believe God is good and I believe God is loving. He's not always very gentle with us, but I believe that God, has us and hasn't forgotten us. And I tell people that I think of myself as the man who built his house upon the rock in Matthew 7. In my short-sightedness, I thought, oh, you know what? Hey, the winds came and it obliterated the house on the sand, but this guy, he was a follower of Jesus. He practiced the teachings of Jesus. His house was standing and it's all perfect and it's wonderful. And the reality is if a wind, a storm, rain came, like it sounds like it could just destroy a house on the sand, there's probably some damage to that house. The roof might be blown off, the windows blown out, but the foundation is standing. And that's what I think our family has discovered is what it means to rebuild upon that foundation that's still standing. And a big part of that is just coming alongside each other and allowing each other to grieve as we need to grieve, coming alongside people that knew Adam and allow them to grieve as they need to grieve, come alongside his students, coming alongside people who don't just heard of his story and were touched. But it has been a journey for the last year and a half that's going to continue for the rest of our lives. And we've had to come to terms with that we are living in a shadow, and that's okay. That God has us right where we're meant to be. As hard as that is, we can lean into who God is, and that's how we get through it.
Yeah, it's impossible to imagine that reality that you and your family have lived through, especially when it's your kids. You don't think of it going down that way. I'm really curious to know, how does one continue to lead and live out their calling while grieving so deeply?
I think you have to understand it's going to look different. Like what was is not going to be ever again. And there are pressures that both myself and my wife and Adam's wife, Maddie, had where people wanted us to be the people that we were before Adam passed. And we have all come to the conclusion that all of us died that day. And that the people that still remain are going to be different people, still with some of the same characteristics, still with some of the same quirks and joys, but we're just going to be different. And you have to give yourself grace to say, who I am as a leader is going to look different. And I had to communicate that to my church. So even right as I was taking this time away and grieving. I wrote an email to our church and I just said, "Hey, here's what we're going through." And I told them, "Hey, when you see us and we're not standing and singing at church, just know that we're worshiping in our heart. And when you see us and we don't look like we want to hug, just know it's not because we don't like you. It's just that we're needing some space." And so you have to kind of redefine who you are as that leader, because the pressure is going to be who you were before and to do all that you did before, and you just can't do that. You have to acknowledge, "I'm a different person, and this is going to be different moving forward." What really helped me, be honest with you, is because of my mentality of, I'm investing in the next generation of leaders to take over. I mean, my team ran the whole church for 3 months. They were young leaders, all in their 20s and 30s, and they ran the church, and I didn't even do anything for 3 months. And I came back, and the whole church had been grieving, and so, take the time to allow everybody to grieve, because even though a lot of our people in our church didn't know Adam, just to know that we were grieving so deeply, it rocked our church. Our church doesn't normally have a prayer meeting, but the night that Adam passed away, like 60 people from our church just spontaneously gathered at our church to pray for our family, because they knew that we were just in such deep, deep trauma and grief. So I would say, first of all, if you're going to lead while grieving, give yourself the grace to really grieve. Take time off as long as they'll give you. My church actually said I could take more, and I decided it had been long enough. And so we came back, at the end of the summer, and Adam passed away at the beginning of the summer. The second thing I would say is, you need to surround yourself with people, and these are different people that can really support you in this journey. And so I had two different types of men in my life. Some are what I call my 5-minute friends. Debbie and I have this couple in our lives. They've been there for us. And when we got the news of Adam's death, we called them and they dropped everything. They're at our house in 5 minutes and drove us to where Adam was and stayed with us for days. Completely just stopped things. There were other men across the country who, when I called, they stopped everything and took my phone call, and we could talk and cry for as long as I needed to talk and cry. And so you have to have people in your life that will do the hardships of life with you, and you have to have them before the tragedy strikes. One of the things that Debbie and I say is our marriage is actually stronger now than it was before Adam passed, but that's because we had developed habits of dating, of talking, of walking together, of and reading God's word together, and all of those things continued right after Adam passed, and that's what sustained us, is that we had developed these habits. I had developed these friendships before Adam passed. And so when the tragedy struck, I knew who to call and lean into that. And then thirdly, the second group of men, I guess I'd say not third, but I had counselors already in my life. I had people that were therapists and licensed counselors that I could go to and not just have a pastoral conversation, but actually, go deeper in that journey. And so that was helpful. In fact, I had a counselor, my wife had a different counselor. Our son had a different counselor. We had a family counselor. I mean, we had a variety of people speaking into our lives to kind of help us through that season.
I'm just so sorry. And to see, kind of firsthand. Yeah, I feel like the thing that's lost in grief a lot of times as you look at the classic phases of grief is that like the final one, not that that means you're done with grief, but one of the final things to emerge when you're grieving is purpose. When you can really when you can really take the pain and find a purpose in it. That's how you know you're in an okay place. I think of it like grief is like the worst dance partner, right? Like just when you find a rhythm, it steps on your toes and reminds you. It'll be that anniversary. It'll be a holiday. It'll be a birthday. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, it really isn't five phases of grief. It's five emotions of grief that are all happening at the same time.
Faces of grief. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it's constantly going, you're bouncing continuously from, you know, denial to anger to depression, back to denial, back to anger, back to bargaining, back to, you know, all right, I'm okay. Purpose, you know, we're going to start this foundation. And then, you know, you're right. There's something that triggers the emotions again, and you're right back in it. And I think I actually wouldn't encourage people to say, what stage of grief am I in? Because you're going to be in them all, and you're going to be in them all for a while. And they're going to come at you at waves that are going to be kind of disjointed. So there's not going to be necessarily a rhythm to it. But what I have learned, excuse me, is that grief is a ball in a jar. And I think I've shared this illustration with you, Corey, but it's not that over time the grief gets less. It's over time the jar gets bigger. And so that grief is always going to be just as big as it ever has been in your life, but who you are is going to grow. And so your capacity to handle it and other people and new opportunities is going to expand. And so, yeah, a year and a half after Adam's passing, I love talking about Adam. I mean, I love telling stories about Adam, and I, you know, my wife and I can go on dates and find fun and joy, but there's also still the reminder, Adam's not here. You know, I'll play with his daughter and realize, man, it should be him holding her right now. It shouldn't be me. And it'll just hit me, you know, again and hard. And it's just, that's going to be the rest of my life. And that has to be something I accept and acknowledge as the way it should be. I tell my students, my favorite line from any movie or television show is from WandaVision, and it's when Vision says, what is grief if not love persevering?
Yeah.
I don't want my grief to go away because I want my love for Adam to always be present. And so if grief is the price of love, then so be it. I'll sit with that because it won't stop things altogether. It'll change it, but it won't stop me from what I need to be doing.
When you decided, all right, 3 months, I'm going to step back in. Were you mindful of your pace? Obviously, you said everything was different. Did you find yourself tempted to jump back in, you know, as though nothing had happened? Was that impossible to do given the tragedy that you and Debbie had just gone through? Like, talk me through what reentry felt like.
What made it most difficult is you're back and everybody wants to know how you're doing, right?
Yeah.
But they don't really want to know how you're doing, right? Yeah. They're like, hey, how you doing? And I'm like, so I made up the tagline, taking it one day at a time.
Yeah.
Because most people, we use how are you doing as our way of saying hello.
That's a salutation.
Exactly. And so the reality is you're in this season where everybody is excited to see you. And they all want to know how you're doing, but they don't really have the time to hear the full story. And so you end up having to fake it a little bit just to kind of get through those moments. You know what I mean? And so you kind of give what you have to give. When I came back, you know, I was starting back up at Biola again because I had the summer off to kind of grieve. And Biola was very gracious with me with my summer courses that I had agreed to teach before Adam passed. And so everybody was very gracious with us with their work expectations. It was just, how do we handle the interactions? I think that was the most difficult for us to navigate. And so that's where I think we just, you know, we're still in deep hurt that we had to find, you know, what are the ways that we're going to re-engage with people So we re-engaged in some things, but we didn't go back to our small group Bible study that we were a part of for another 6 months, right? So in other words, yeah, we're back at the church, but we weren't back doing everything we would have done with the church. And I found things that would be productive for me. So for example, the messages that I preached when I first got back, I did a whole series on heaven and what is heaven like, the present heaven, what are we going to do in heaven? Because I had spent the whole summer reading about heaven, because I had a very cartoonish view of heaven, you know? And so by reading all these books and studying, and I put together this sermon series, it was very cathartic for me to think about where is Adam right now and what is Adam doing right now? And Maddie and I, Adam's wife, we still talk of Adam in the present tense. We say Adam is, because, you know, as a follower of Jesus, he is in heaven. And who he is bodily is everything what he is in heaven now, you know, and his personality and his memories, they're all part of him in heaven. And so I did things like that that were very helpful and cathartic. That, you know, so I eased back into my responsibilities in that way.
Did you have moments that you found yourself angry? You know, God, I mean, it's a very natural part of grief, but like, God, here, okay, I'm gonna go serve your people today with this, you know, tragically empty cup that you've dealt me. Give me some of that, just kind of insight to what those moments felt like as a pastor, as a professor, as a husband, as a father, all those things.
I still can't make sense of it, you know, because it was a brain aneurysm. So on my arm, I have my sweatshirt on, but I actually have Adam's handwriting tattooed, made in God's image. And I did this because in a season when I was angry, I had to remind myself, God made Adam good, and he made him with this brain defect. And that is exactly how God wanted Adam. And I had to kind of talk myself down. Like, there's no one at fault here. No one messed up. No one sinned. No one did anything. It simply was God allowed this. And I would be especially angry when I would see, you know, people that truly don't deserve a second and third and 14th chance.
Oh, yeah.
God redeeming them, right? You know, the person who's a drug addict that, you know, I've with the fire department, I'll go on and like, God, you're sparing this person's life who's worthy in your kingdom, yes, but come on, you allowed a 24-year-old youth pastor to pass away right before his daughter was born, and you're gonna save a drug addict to go get high again another day. I'd be angry then. When I saw grandpas playing with their adult children and then their grandchildren, I just realized, okay, that's never going to be us. And I'd have a tinge of jealousy and just kind of like, okay, you know, so my whole arm, you can't see it now, but it's just tatted with Adam, his tattoos. And I call my arm Adam's arm. And it's just, I had to have this visual reminder that God has a, it has us on a journey, and he hasn't left us on this journey. And therefore, I just have to keep coming back to, all right, God, you're a good God. You love us, and you designed Adam with good. And that's, you know, all the days ordained for his life were in your book, and yet they came up to a lot shorter than I wish they would have been.
I appreciate your honesty there. I think it's on one hand, you know, most of the people who listen to this podcast are ministry leaders themselves. On the other hand, if someone was just casually listening, it might be an assumption that people have. Well, you know, if anyone's going to go through something hard, let it be a pastor. They're built for that. You know, they teach that, they counsel that. And my experience with grief and death and even just frustration or unmet expectations around big life circumstances, I'm the worst person to be going through this because I throw the towel in so fast. When the going gets tough, I just want to quit. I want to draw the blinds and turn on a show and just get lost. Because sometimes the reality is overwhelming. I think it's so interesting, Dave, that you and I got connected the week before my mom passed. And then I got to spend time with you and Debbie and Maddie and really the beautiful work that your foundation's doing throughout the fall. And those events were really good. I didn't necessarily hit the goals that I wanted, but that was just a self-imposed desire. And I believe I've said this to you, but I can't help but wonder if that's the timing of it was surreal, and then the proximity that we got to have. It meant a lot to me, and how freely you share your story and the grief that you've experienced is such an encouragement to me, because Jesus promises it, right? He promises in this world you will have trouble. And I think a lot of our church culture and even just our kind of whitewashed Southern California culture doesn't prepare us for the harsh realities of life. And when someone's going through it in the ways that you and your family have, I pay close attention because we're all going to be in that seat in some way, shape, or form at some point. And for you to continue to lead the church and teach, and then to birth a foundation out of it, my God, what a commendable way to find purpose in that pain.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that affirmation and recognition. It definitely is a journey. And it's a journey that I'm not the only one. I've met a lot of dads, unfortunately, who have lost children of us. I've met a lot of pastors. And if I've heard one thing from my students at Biola and the same thing from my people at my church is my honesty with my struggle of, God, I thought I was, doing it right, so I shouldn't have to go through this. People have appreciated that vulnerability. And I think if you're a leader going through difficult or grieving times, yeah, there's some wisdom about how much to share because people don't want to hear every black story or dark moment, but the fact that, hey, you know what? And I'm struggling and I'm questioning and my faith has gone through a storm and but I still believe. And I think that's what's important for them to hear, that we could walk through seasons of lament, but we still say, I still believe. I don't necessarily agree with everything that took place. I'm not like, yay, God. I've never have said, God, I'm so thankful that Adam passed. I've never said that, but I have said, God, thank you for that you're with me in this season. I've said, God, thank you for your strength in this season. And so I think just to be honest with those you're leading, because they need to know that when they go through hard times, it's okay to have questions and doubts. It's okay to say, God, what is going on? And if we give them the appearance that that's sinful to have any type of doubt or question in the face of hardships, we're setting our people up for a failure. And so I think by modeling it has really helped a lot of my people at our church and my students at school understand it's okay to grieve with hard questions, and God's big enough to handle that.
And you getting to teach that wisdom, Dave, from a place of experience, while not something we would ever wish on somebody, certainly adds a desire to listen when you talk about these things. So on one hand, like I said, I'm just so sorry you had to go through it. On the other hand, you have a lot of wisdom to share. And granted, I'm sure you'd trade every ounce of that wisdom for another day with your boy.
So, yeah.
There are people, especially leaders, that are going through just such hard things, and then having to show up and to teach and preach, or to counsel, or to lead, to strategize, to shepherd, whatever it may be. How you do that from a place of such intense grief is beside me. I'm thankful to know you, man. I really am. I'm thankful for what you've shared with me, and even just our short time of knowing each other. I want to be mindful of time, but also I don't really care, because this is a great conversation. But if there's a leader that's just maybe in the grip of grief right now, can't figure out which way is up, maybe they're in their pain, they're rethinking everything and just ready to walk away from the calling God's placed on their life. What advice would you share with that person? The one that wants to quit.
You know, there were definite days when all I could do was pray simple breath prayers. I mean, like, help me, God. Help me, God. You know, like, I'd mix it up a little bit. Sometimes I would just say, be with me, God. But I didn't have any grand prayer or, you know, verse I was quoting. I literally was just saying, God, help. And I think by doing that, it just kind of gave me the ability to remain under the pain. And I use that word intentionally, because that's kind of the idea of the word steadfastness in that's used in the book of James, when it talks about being steadfast in your, you know, that will be produced when you go through struggles. And that word steadfastness really is not a passive waiting, but it's an active endurance. It's choosing to remain instead of trying to escape. And so by just simply saying, God, help me, you know, help me, God, it was kind of my way of just staying in the moment and not making a decision in the pain. And Debbie and I made that commitment to each other that we were not going to make any major decisions for 1 year. Whether it was, because we were even talking about moving and downsizing our house before Adam passed, you know, and so we put that all on hold. We didn't make any decisions about jobs. We didn't make any decisions about finances. We, for a year, we just allowed ourselves to remain. And I learned to ask two really important questions. I asked, what's happening right now that makes me want to give up? In other words, this pain has been happening for a while here. What is going on to change my desire to remain under? Is there something new that's been introduced? And if I can be honest about what I'm really facing, then it gives me some understanding of how I might need to change something small without actually giving up, because I've identified a new thread in the situation. And so that's been very helpful for me to try to just push pause and say, why am I wanting to quit so badly right now? What changed? What's going on? What, I was okay. And I understand grief's going to come as waves, but did anything else change? And if nothing really else changed, then just to realize, okay, this is a wave of grief. Like, I'm standing in the waves of the ocean. I just have to remain a little harder. You know what I mean? And so, you know, there's nothing to change, because it's just the next wave of grief. But I also spent a lot of time reflecting on what's true no matter what. In other words, to remember that God loves me, that God is with me, that God did not intend for life to be like this, but he allowed it. And so those were questions that helped me think about, how do I remain under in this moment, that even though I want to escape and I want this to be a nightmare that's I wake up from, that, okay, you know, there's a journey here that we're in, and we're going to go at the pace that we have to go at where God has for us.
What's making me want to quit, and what's true no matter what?
Right.
So good. Dave, as we wrap up our time together, maybe you could share a little bit more about the foundation.
Thank you.
How people could get involved to donate, participate, because I think a lot of the wisdom that you've just shared is expressed in the work that the foundation is doing. And it's such a legacy, as you said, the work that Adam was doing gets to continue on through the work that the foundation is able to produce. And share with the people listening a little bit about that.
Well, I hope you'll put a link to our website in the podcast, bio.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
But it's just simply Adam Keene Foundation, and Keene is spelled K-E-E-H-N. So it's adamkeenefoundation.com. And we started this foundation because Adam was a new youth pastor, and he started right before COVID hit. And so his journey of building his ministry happened in the most difficult season of ministry history, in my mind, at least in my 38 years of ministry. That was the
Sure.
hardest thing ever. But Adam thrived in his ministry. His ministry grew even during that time. And it was partly because he had a lot of mentors that he was bouncing questions off of, that he had was going to and getting resources from and talking about creative ways to do it. And what I loved about what he was doing, I was like, Adam, that is so innovative, right? The way you're doing this and meeting up with students digitally and virtually, and you know, the things you're doing were just amazing, because he was in the tightest lockdown county of the country, of LA County, right? He couldn't do anything for so long. And then when he passed, I'm like, I want to come alongside the next Adam. There's other youth pastors just starting off, and they're in a difficult season of ministry. And you know what? If they struggle in the very beginning of ministry, they might walk away from it. I've had students that have walked away from ministry after one short, you know, season, or friends when I was in college that walked away from ministry, you know, because it was just hard. And when a youth pastor walks away from ministry, you're losing the next generation of teaching pastors and lead pastors and senior pastors, because eventually that's the pool that will draw from. And so I want to do something to help the next Adam, and that's what our foundation has come to this rally. Like, we want to give the next Adam the resources they need to do it. And so there's two things we offer. One is a new youth pastor starter kit. It's simply some downloads that they could do. It's some scholarships to join a coaching organization that will kind of help them along. I mean, some coaching. It gives them a book or two to kind of add to their library. And then we do these leadership coaching huddles, where basically it could be a small group, or it might be one-on-one, where we're just coming alongside a young youth pastor and helping them think and dream, what could I do to reach my community for the gospel? And then as they dream about what could become, then our foundation funds those dreams. We actually just give money away to these young youth pastors. We give it to the church so that they could use this money to do something that they want to do to reach their community for Christ. And you know, so all the money we receive, we just turn around and give it away. No one takes a dime from this organization on a personal nature. It's all given away to resources for young youth pastors to keep young youth pastors in the game when the going gets tough. And so, yeah, those are the two things that we do. We come alongside organizations like your own and want to encourage you and others, because we believe that what you're doing and training up youth pastors needs to be encouraged as well. So, yeah, that's kind of the goal, is just to keep others serving in the ministry God has for them as long as they can.
That's amazing. And that's the Adam Keene Foundation. You could Google it. You could find it on Instagram as well. That's amazing. Well, Dave, thank you so much for sharing both your time and your story with us. There's so much wisdom in what you shared, really from start to finish. So I hope that today's episode is an encouragement to those of you who listened. Dave, really appreciate your time, man. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
God bless.
Wonderful. Hey, I hope you guys have a wonderful week. Be sure to check out the Adam Keene Foundation. There'll be a link in the show notes as well if you'd like to get in contact with Dave and see and hear more about the work that he's doing. I hope you guys have an incredible week. And if you find yourself in a season of grief while leading, don't do it alone. Reach out to somebody. Heck, reach out to me. I'd love to walk with you in that. Have a good week, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Is a nonprofit organization that exists to connect, care for, equip, and encourage young ministry leaders. To learn more about us or support us, please visit onwardleader.com.